from Northwest. And I hear them honkers again on their rounding quest over Lord's Valley. I'll roll like a bone. Step in that old light walking wolf, hungry as always. Long legs and long ears and tail, and long, long well. I had no goose and I tried to keep her, but she awake and I the sleeper. She flew away, left me the weeper. But there ain't no chill
Michael Hurley right there with his original version of Wild Geese's, which we heard Richard Dawson cover earlier in the program from
Michael's 1999 release
known as Weatherhole. We heard The Fronts. I want to learn more about this band making a racket in the 1980s. What a bunch of lunacy. Haven't had a chance to learn much about it now, but Mowing the Lawn is what we heard from The Fronts' Mamo Waves. We heard from Agitation Free's second record in 1973. The song was In the Silence of the Morning Sunrise. We heard Carissa Thivayou, pardon my Greek, from a great new comp on Mississippi called Aman Aman, Greek Anatolian Laments. The song was Sabah Mains. The Albert Mangelsdorf Quartet did Never Let It End from a new spiritual jazz comp number 17. And the Native Hipsters at the top of that set with part two of There Goes Concord Again. Hey, I want to thank a few volunteers who are helping out in the library today. We had Dennis in there and Cabe and Amy. Thank you all for your help. If you want to help out, volunteer at FMU, reach out to me, scott@wfmu.org. I can hook you up. Looking forward to seeing you next week, friends, when Ava Mendoza is my live guest, playing solo electric guitar in the studio. Till then, you're tuned to Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Here comes Mark. Tectonic is next.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. So happy that you have chosen to join me today for this episode. Now, over the years, every so often, I have run what I call a dystopia update, in which I go through a number of recent news stories just to keep you apprised of the metastatic growth of this cancerous Silicon Valley surveillance and control technology and the associated systems and platforms that are now pervading every aspect of life, work, politics, society, education, entertainment, and everything else. And as you would expect from a description like that, it tends to be rather bad news, creepy, disturbing, gloom-inducing news. Well, today is different because I am here to give you a dystopia update that is a good news edition in line with the recent shows I've been doing that have been trying to spotlight some good news in our otherwise distressing landscape. There are some isolated elements of good news. And in fact, in this case, I think I have some examples of good news that are, I hope, harbingers of things to come. So they're not just isolated examples of this was good and that was good. It's that these are the leading indicators, I hope, of where society is going to go as we all begin to push back on the toxic and harmful and in some cases lethal hegemony of these illegal and unethical surveillance monopolies. So I have four main stories to go through, and then I've got, if I have time, and I think I will, I've got a little surprise for you after we get these four stories discussed. And I won't say more about the surprise right now. You're just going to have to listen to the end of the show to hear that. But the four stories I'm going to cover all have a good news aspect to them, and they all have to do with Silicon Valley. One is that the video AI slot generator called Sora has shut down. The second is that Facebook is shutting down its metaverse. Third is that Facebook has lost two major court trials. And then fourth, we're going to spend some time on this. Facebook's spy glasses are now receiving some pushback as the inevitable truth about them comes to light. Why don't we start with the first one about Sora? And before I dive in, I'll just remind you that, as always, I have posted my sources. If you want to see the sources for today's show, and I'm going to go through a lot of them, go to the Tectonic website and find the episode page. The Tectonic website is at tectonic.fm. That's tectonic.fm. And you just click the episode link for Dystopia Update, Good News Edition, and you can see all sorts of links to the stories. In some cases, I've procured some GIF links for you so you can get past paywalls. And there are a couple of relevant, I'm counting them, there are three or four relevant memes that are embedded on the page as well, in addition to my normal memes that I do on the playlist. At any rate, whether you are listening soon after this or sometime in the future, I hope that that episode page serves as a resource to you to go and dive in further. I mean, certainly you can double check to make sure I've got my facts right, but beyond that, dive in further to see what else you can learn from these sources, because I'm just giving you a rather cursory overview of these four stories. All right, let's get started. The first story is video AI slot generator Sora shuts down. Now, if you haven't been keeping track of this, and I don't blame you if you'd rather not, there's a company, OpenAI. This is the one that makes ChatGPT. It's headed up by Sam Altman. And some time ago, they made this huge announcement that now they don't just use their plagiarism machine to spit out or excrete extruded text product. Now they can do it with video as well. So the idea for a user is that if you go to Sora, you'd be able to type in a prompt, just like you would do with ChatGPT, you know, write me a plagiarized essay on Red Badge of Courage. You can do the same thing in Sora, write a prompt that says, I don't know, show me a video of unicorns on roller skates or something, and it would go on from there. And it would create an extruded video product that more or less kind of matched your prompt. And the idea was that OpenAI was going to be improving this continually and selling it into Hollywood so that Hollywood could then replace, you know, human actors and directors with AI slop. And then if they could create AI slop movies, their costs would go down, and surely American and global consumers would love to watch videos, two-hour videos, movies, built out of AI slop. Well, it turns out, as of March 24, 2026, the New York Times reports that OpenAI is shutting down Sora, which the Times calls its AI video generator. They missed the word slop in the headline. I'm sure that was just an oversight. And the story says that OpenAI is shutting down Sora, shocking entertainment executives with its ability to use AI to quickly produce short videos that looked as if a Hollywood studio had made them. Now, the story goes on to tell the inroads that OpenAI was beginning, or it appeared to begin to make into Hollywood. The story says just 3 months ago that would be, you know, beginning of 2026, OpenAI and Disney signed a 3-year licensing deal allowing Sora users to generate videos with Disney characters like Mickey Mouse, Cinderella, and Yoda. Can you think, listeners, can you think what Sora users might prompt Sora with in order to make short videos of any kind, and I mean any kind, that feature Mickey Mouse, Cinderella, and Yoda and associated characters? Jason Kebler, our friend who's been on the show a number of times, he's from 404 Media. He wrote on March 25th, Disney's Sora disaster shows AI will not revolutionize Hollywood. And he says that Disney is pulling out of its $1 billion investment entirely. It was hard to imagine why Disney would infect its flagship paid streaming service with content from a service whose viral videos consisted of users turning Pikachu into a felon and SpongeBob into Hitler. It was not clear why Disney would want AI slop made by randos to live next to, say, the $200 million Toy Story 4 or any number of Disney's masterpieces. And it goes on to talk about, you know, why would Disney sign on for Sam Altman's plagiarism machine? Excellent question. I think Disney finally woke up to the awful prospects of what it was handing its IP, its characters, its brand, its own customers into an experience of AI slop that had really no bottom in terms of the depraved and disgusting content that would be infecting the internet as a result. So that was the decline and now the disappearance of OpenAI's Sora. But that was not the only thing that disappeared. This is from Brian Merchant on March 27, 2026. He writes, and Brian's been on the show as well. I think it's fitting, he writes, that the same week that OpenAI announced the shutdown of Sora, Meta, that is to say Facebook, announced the imminent shutdown of Horizon Worlds, its splashiest showcase for the metaverse. So, more good news. First, we see that Sora has been shut down as Disney, and Disney is not usually the good guy on this show. It's a giant corporation. But Disney, I will give it credit in that it woke up to, as I said, the very negative possibilities of this investment into OpenAI. Similarly, Facebook Meta has run into the brick wall of reality. With ironically enough, with its virtual reality world, this Horizon Worlds, and has shut down the metaverse. Now, if you remember a couple of years ago, Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook Meta, well, at the time it was Facebook was the name of his empire, was going to pivot, that word that the tech bros love, it was going to pivot and go all in on VR. Everything was going to be VR. And you remember they had the metaverse and they had all of these demo videos about what it was going to look like, and people made fun of it because it looked like technology from roughly 1992 style graphics, and the avatars, as they were called, did not have legs. I mean, there are all sorts of problems. And Zuckerberg did not listen to any of the criticism. He just went on, and by some accounts, Zuckerberg spent on the order of $80 billion on the metaverse, this idea that was not going to work. And indeed, it did not work. And it has now been shut down, or at least Zuckerberg has announced the imminent shutdown sometime in June. As CNBC writes on March 18, Meta is shutting down Horizon Worlds, the company's virtual reality social network, on June 15, in order to prioritize artificial intelligence. So look, Zuck says, you know, the company that was called Facebook, he renamed to Meta when he announced the pivot to the metaverse, because that's how important this was. He renamed his company to Meta, And now the company called Meta is shutting down the metaverse, and he's pivoting again to AI. You got to wonder how that one's going to work out. And on the episode page, which you can find at tectonic.fm, there's this little meme that I've posted, one of those two-panel memes that on the left panel it has what they want you to think the metaverse is, and it shows these young people looking very stylish and cool with these metaverse glasses on. And then on the right panel it says what it actually is, and it shows someone huddled in a corner wearing the glasses, looking like they're at the end of their rope. So you have to wonder, what is it about these billionaires that would possess somebody like Mark Zuckerberg, to go and invest $80 billion in an idea that, I mean, I was deriding on this show as soon as he announced it. And it wasn't just me. Many tech critics were calling this a failure from the get-go. And as they were issuing little demos and little videos and little press releases and showing sneak peeks, all of it looked disappointing. I mean, comically disappointing. So it's no surprise that it didn't work. And finally, Zuck had to throw in the towel after burning $80 billion. You think, didn't he have any reflection on what he was doing? Didn't he have any sort of internal, I don't know, conversation about what he's doing? Because after all, friends, some people, or I'd say many people, many of us have a habit in life of reflecting on what we're here for, whether the work we do aligns with our values. We do things like we meditate, or we read novels. You know, fiction is so helpful. Or we join a civic or religious or interest group of some sort in order to be in community with others, to learn from others. But not the oligarchs like Mark Zuckerberg, apparently not. And there was this video clip that was making the rounds within the last week or so that I wanted to share with you, because another one of the Silicon Valley oligarchs came out and said some interesting things out loud about his internal state. This was Marc Andreessen, the vastly wealthy and influential venture capitalist, was on a podcast, and he was asked about introspection. And I thought his response was very interesting. Here is Marc Andreessen.
You don't have any levels of introspection?
Yes, zero. As little as possible.
Why?
Move forward. Go. Yeah, I don't know. I found people who dwell in the past get stuck in the past. It's a real problem, and it's a problem at work, and it's a problem at home.
So I've read, obviously, 400, I think now 10 biographies of history's greatest entrepreneurs, yep. And that was one of the most surprising things. Like, what's the most surprising thing that you've learned from this? It's like, oh, they have little or zero introspection.
Yep.
Like, Sam Walton didn't wake up thinking about his internal self. He just woke up. He's like, I like building Walmart. I'm going to keep building Walmart. I'm going to make more Walmarts, and just kept doing it over and over again.
And you probably know, if you go back, before 100 years ago, it never would have occurred to anybody to be introspective. Like, it's the whole idea of, I mean, just all of the modern conceptions around introspection and therapy and all the things that kind of result from that are, you know, kind of a manufacture of the 1910s, 1920s.
Say more about that.
Great men of history didn't sit around doing this stuff at any prior point, right? It's all a new construct. First Western civilization had to kind of invent the concept of the individual, right? Which was like a new concept, you know, several hundred years ago. And then, you know, for a long time, it was, all right, the individual runs, right, and like does all these things and builds things and, you know, builds empires and builds companies and builds technology and does all these things. And then, you know, kind of this kind of guilt-based whammy, you know, kind of showed up from Europe, a lot of it from Vienna in the 1910s, 1920s, Freud and all that entire movement, and kind of turned all that inward and basically said, okay, now we need to, like, you know, basically second guess the individual. We need to criticize the individual. The individual needs to self-criticize. Right. The individual needs to feel guilt, needs to look backwards, needs to, you know, dwell on the past. It never resonated with me.
All right. So that was Marc Andreessen talking about his lack of introspection, and very proudly, because he says that it's all a construct. You know, the internal life is something that the great men in history never engaged in. And this was all something that was invented in the 1910s, 1920s in Vienna with Freud and the rest. Where do you start with this? Where do you start with thinking that is so uneducated? I don't want to just dump on Mark Andreessen. The poor guy apparently hasn't read a book in a number of years. So I feel sort of sorry for him that is his conception of history and the human experience. We could start with, I know the tech bros tend to like some of these old classic philosophers. Has Andreessen not encountered Socrates? You know, the unexamined life is not worth living. Of course, that was Plato writing what Socrates said, so maybe he's also not aware of Plato. Is he aware of Aristotle, who extended Plato's and Socrates' thinking? Is he not aware of Marcus Aurelius and his book Meditations, which is an entire book on introspection? He probably has not heard of Shakespeare and a play that Shakespeare wrote called Hamlet. I would recommend it to Mark Andreessen. There's a great speech that starts with "To be or not to be," which is all about introspection that Andreessen apparently is not aware of. How about Descartes? Descartes had this catchphrase, "I think, therefore I am," which is basically saying, "I know I exist because I engage in introspection." And all of these are several hundred to a couple thousand years old, and Andreessen is apparently unaware of all of those. The most charitable thing I can say is that possibly what Andreessen was trying to say is that the nature of consciousness has changed and evolved somewhat over the centuries. And for that, I would agree. And for that, I would point him to a book by Julian Jaynes about consciousness, a classic book. But given that Andreessen apparently has not read Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Aurelius, or Shakespeare, or Descartes, he's got a lot of reading to do before he gets up to Julian Jaynes, so I'm not going to dive into that. It's just a bizarre statement until, friends, you understand that this is the world that the oligarchs live in. They're surrounded by people who tell them they're brilliant. And they use these AI models, these sycophantic AI models, that increasingly tell them they're brilliant. So they're surrounded by people and bots all day, telling them, "You're brilliant, you're brilliant. Everything you say is so smart." And when they say something that is so patently absurd and reveals a level of ignorance and uneducated thinking, there's no break. There's no one to come out of the woodwork and say, "That's really stupid." In fact, the podcast host, far from criticizing him, only seemed to speed up his already 2x speech. What is it with these guys speaking as fast as they can? I don't mind speaking at a normal level. I mean, I don't know what else to say about this. But I think it does give you a sense of where the oligarchs are in their thinking or lack thereof, that then sets the conditions for them to make these massive errors. And so they must be surprised when reality comes and delivers a win for the rest of us, for the good guys. And that is, in fact, what happened in the third story. This is good news, more good news. The story is Facebook's Ray-Bans, now called... that's story number four, sorry. The story number three is Facebook loses two court trials. This was huge, huge news in the tech landscape, and it's going to affect all of us for the better. What happened was that Facebook/Meta was in court on two different issues. There were two different trials going on. One was in New Mexico and one was in California. And they, coincidentally, they both handed down judgments or verdicts in the last week or so. And both of them were against Facebook Meta. So it's really good news. There's a piece in The Guardian by Jonathan Friedland, March 27, 2026, that gave a nice summary. So I'll just read this off. First came the verdict in New Mexico, which fined Facebook Meta $375 million, that's 280 million pounds, for enabling harm, including child sexual exploitation, on its platforms, and for misleading consumers about their safety. 24 hours later, jurors in California awarded $6 million in damages to a young user who had argued that Meta, Facebook Meta, along with Google's YouTube, had deliberately designed addictive products that had hooked her from childhood, causing her grave harm. So basically what we have here, friends, is two different trials came up and took Facebook Meta to court to say, hey, you are harming children and you have designed your service to harm children and we are going to bring you to account for the harmful results that you have caused. Of course, Facebook Meta had these defenses saying, oh, it's not our fault. It's the user's fault. We're just neutral actors. We didn't do anything wrong. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg went on the stand in the California trial in Los Angeles and said, I didn't want to overdetermine the consumer's experience. I thought it would be paternalistic or something like that, where it was totally disingenuous. So I can read a little more of this Guardian piece. The court in New Mexico heard how a former Facebook Meta employee wrote to Zuckerberg, urging him to see the danger in allowing young girls access to cosmetic surgery, a cosmetic surgery filter on Instagram that let people see how they look with bigger eyes or thicker lips. The colleague emailed Zuckerberg to say that one of his daughters had been hospitalized twice for body dysmorphia. And when it came to body image, the pressure on them and their peers coming through social media is intense. Zuckerberg, says the Guardian piece, was unmoved. And then it mentions Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen, who leaked what became known as the Facebook files a couple years ago, used to work in Facebook's civic integrity team, told the Guardian journalist how colleagues at Facebook might propose a small tweak that would substantially reduce the harm the platform was doing. But if that tweak caused so much as a 1% drop in user engagement, the bosses would veto it. As Haugen puts it, Mark Zuckerberg said the most important thing is increasing time spent on the platform. So it's good news that both of these trials were decided for the rest of us, not for the oligarch, because Facebook has been harming who knows how many of thousands or millions of children for who knows how many years. This has been by design. They have been monetizing the harm to children. Frankly, as I've said before on the show, it's outrageous that this company is allowed to exist. I don't understand why we haven't. I do understand, but let me rephrase. I really would like to see a perp walk. I would love to see Mark Zuckerberg in handcuffs marched into a police car to be sent off to prison. I mean, that's the short video we should all be waiting for. Because as soon as we have a tech oligarch in handcuffs, marched off to prison, then things are really going to change. But in the meantime, we have these court trials. And I'll say that the first one, the judgment was for $375 million. That's not nothing. I mean, really, these judgments should be in the many, many billions of dollars, but that's a start. The California judgment was for $6 million. So you might say that doesn't seem like much. However, the thing about the California trial is that it opens the path for other claimants to come forward and start their own trials. As Axios put it on March 27, the California case is tied to more than 2,000 other pending lawsuits, meaning the monetary penalties could add up quick. So if you do 2,000 times 6 million, that's 12 billion. Who knows, maybe if 2,000 people are getting 6 million each between them and their legal teams, maybe more than 2,000 come forward. I mean, the numbers could add up. 12 billion would not do a whole lot to Facebook, but at 12 billion here and at 12 billion there, at, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg just burned 80 billion on the metaverse, those numbers eventually are going to start stacking up. So this is good news. Now, I will acknowledge, yes, Facebook Meta is going to appeal this. They are going to throw up all sorts of obstacles. They have the best paid legal team, I'm sure, in the world, who are going to be doing everything in their power to serve their feudal lord, who does not intend to take responsibility for anything that he's ever done, nor is he ever going to want to pay a dollar to in favor of the people he's harmed along the way. To acknowledge, there's no acknowledgement of anything that he's done. So it's going to take years probably for this to play out, but at least we should celebrate while we can. Celebrate the wins we have while we can, because as I said, the dystopia update is so often a rather gloomy affair. There are other links about the Facebook trials and the outcomes and analysis on the episode page, which you can get to at the Tectonic website, tectonic.fm. That's T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And you want to click into the episode called Dystopia Update, Good News Edition, which is what we're doing here today, if you're just tuning in. My name is Mark Hurst. You're listening to Tectonic, and we're about halfway through the Good News Edition of the Dystopia Update. We have covered two of the four good news stories from the tech landscape. And I think we can, no, actually we've done three. Sorry, I'm having trouble counting tonight, friends. We did the video AI slop generator called Sora has shut down. Facebook is shutting down its metaverse. And Facebook has lost two major court trials that then opened the way for thousands more of the same type. So now let's get to the fourth story out of the four good news stories. And this one, I will admit, it's not all good news, but I'm trying to put a good news spin on it so that I can fit it in with the rest of the dystopia update. But you can judge me on whether I was able to really give you good news on this one. The name of this one is Facebook's Ray-Bans, now called Pervert Glasses. And if I've done shows on these or mentioned them a number of times in the past, Facebook / Meta has these spy glasses, these surveillance glasses that they're making in partnership with Ray-Ban, which of course is a brand of the company Luxottica. So I'm telling you that just so if you want to boycott, if you want to not only boycott Facebook Meta, which I would recommend, if you also want to boycott Ray-Ban, really you should boycott Luxottica brands, which is unfortunately most of the sunglass brands out there, which is why I now I have given up my Ray-Bans, because I don't want anyone on the street wondering if I'm wearing the Zuck glasses. This is what should happen to anyone wearing Ray-Bans, whether wearing the Zuck glasses or not, because they're getting harder and harder to find, to distinguish from non-surveillance glasses. Here's the deal with these surveillance glasses. Mark Zuckerberg has come out with these Ray-Bans that allow people to video record, that's video and audio, anybody in front of the glasses. So if I'm wearing the surveillance glasses and I go out into public, I can record anybody in the street. If I go into a restaurant where people may have some mild feeling of privacy, I can record the conversations at the next table. If I can hear them, I can record the images of people at the next table. The possibilities from there get much darker. And I want to go through some of these possibilities so that you understand why people are calling them the pervert glasses. And by the way, the good news here is that the nickname of the spy glasses is now pervert glasses. And I would recommend and I would urge you to start calling the Facebook spy glasses the pervert glasses, so that we make it a thing. And it's beginning to happen. There are some people who've written about this, but we could here at Tectonic, the vast Tectonic Empire can make a dent in the universe on this and get your friends, neighbors, colleagues, coworkers to start calling the Facebook glasses the pervert glasses. The reason that you should call them pervert glasses is that one of the use cases is for perverts to go out and record women without their knowledge. And I shouldn't need to give you too many details. You can probably imagine what the perverts are doing with the glasses, but they look to people in your immediate neighborhood as though you're wearing normal Ray-Ban glasses, whereas in fact you are taking a video with audio of the target, in this case, and you're then able to upload it to toxic social media. So there's a futurism piece. This is from March 6, 2026, and the headline is, "People are calling Meta Ray-Bans pervert glasses." And the story says, reportedly, highly sensitive videos recorded by users' Meta Ray-Ban smart glasses are being sent to the company's subcontractors in Nairobi, Kenya, for data annotation. Contractors told the newspapers that they were watching people going to the toilet or getting undressed, often not knowing that they were even recording or being recorded. Automated systems designed to blur faces often failed, effectively giving the contractors a front row seat of someone's most intimate moments. So what's happening here is that in addition to perverts going out into public and recording people, often women, without their knowledge or consent, something that the pervert glasses owners are unaware of is that the footage is often being sent to third-party contractors. This, by the way, is a pattern that we've seen for I don't know how many years with I don't know how many different surveillance devices. We've heard it from the surveillance pucks from other big tech companies that are recording audio from people's homes and bedrooms and sending it over to subcontractors in Africa or Eastern Europe in order for them to annotate the data. This is all in service of feeding the AI slop engines that these companies are all building. So there was a story on February 27 that really broke the story. This is out of Sweden. The source is called Svenska Dagbladet. I'm sorry, I'm not saying that right probably, but the link is on the episode page, and the headline, which is in English, is "She came out of the bedroom naked," employee says. So basically, the Swedish journalists were able to talk to these subcontractors in Kenya who are doing the right thing and saying, hey, by the way, we're seeing things we shouldn't see. So let me just make clear, the perverts are not the subcontractors. The subcontractors are the exploited labor who are the good guys in this case, who are raising the alarm on behalf of all of us and saying, hey, something bad is happening here. So you can read that whole story about the access that Facebook Meta subcontractors have to the footage from these glasses that are often recording when the pervert glasses owners, not to say all of them are perverts, but they own pervert glasses. Those glasses are often recording their most intimate moments. So it's bad all around, but it actually gets worse. Again, the good news here is that people are starting to call them pervert glasses, but as I said, there is some bad news here as well. And I want to play this brief video from an organization called Fight for the Future that talks about one of the possibilities from Zuckerberg's pervert glasses. Here it is.
So imagine you're letting your kid have just a little bit of freedom running around the local arcade, and the next thing they know, some stranger who knows their name, your name, the street you live on, and tons of other details that make them seem trustworthy just comes on up. Meta just announced that they're adding facial recognition to their creepy Meta Ray-Ban glasses. Just weeks after the latest release of Epstein files exposed the largest trafficking ring in modern history. While the world's richest man is being investigated for how his AI bot went wild generating child porn, these glasses could be filming at any time. And worse, these new facial recognition capabilities might let a predator look up people's personal information, especially information on kids or a woman by herself, without anyone knowing that it's happening. Tell all the places that you take your family that they need to put up the poster and pledge to stop Meta's facial recognition Ray-Bans from harming your community.
Right now is what she was going to say. And that, by the way, is from Fight for the Future. And they've put up a site at glasseschildsafety.com. Again, that's glasseschildsafety.com. And on the page, you'll see it says, Meta Ray-Bans are integrating facial rec that puts children, women, and other vulnerable customers in the crosshairs of predators. And the site goes on to give you some resources for, as they said, how to ban these glasses from your store, your place of worship, your school, your hospital, etc., and keep your community safe. really, friends, if you have influence in one of those, a store, a place of worship, a school, a hospital, or I'll just add any other kind of community group, I would urge you to go to the site, glasseschildsafety.com. Get the resources, there are poster designs, there are some tips, and have a conversation with that organization and say, we have to ban the pervert glasses. Because all of those vulnerable people are at risk when they come to our place if the pervert glasses are present. And let me just say something about how women are at risk. There was an article on March 11, 2026, in Glamour UK. The headline is, "From Meta Glasses to Smartwatches, the AI Revolution is Every Woman's Worst Nightmare." And it talks about things like Meta's pervert glasses that are tools for perpetrators to abuse women. The article says, it gives an example, quote, "Molly, whose name has been changed, was filmed in the street non-consensually by a stranger using Meta glasses who approached her while she was feeding her dog. Recalling how the interaction seemed innocent enough, Molly, a full-time content creator, said how she had shared her Instagram username with the man when he asked, out of politeness more than anything, she said. She was unaware that the interaction was being filmed until a male user tagged her in a TikTok video the next day. Molly said, I watched the interaction back and felt this real cold chill over me. I felt hot and cold at the same time. Even though the interaction itself was absolutely fine, I still felt as though something had been taken from me. It felt really violating. Molly explained how the video included private details about her location that the man had now broadcast publicly. What was worse, she said, was that I had told the guy where I lived, as he had asked me. There were comments from men saying he should have followed me home, telling people to look out for me in that area and that everyone should move to the area I mentioned. So this is, I would say, friends, based on the reading that I've done, this is horrible. I'm sorry this happened to the woman who's being listed as Molly. And it's not as bad as, I should say, it is bad. And it even gets worse for other women who have been accosted by predators and actual perverts in real life who are, as I said, filming them with the pervert glasses without their knowledge or consent and, you know, going into bars and hitting on them and having these conversations and manipulating them and then posting the interaction to TikTok or Facebook or Instagram and saying, oh, you know, look what I did. And the woman's privacy is destroyed and she's, you know, she's being exploited for the benefit both of the pervert and his bro-friends and followers, but also for Mark Zuckerberg, who monetizes it. I mean, that's the thing that we have to keep in mind, that these social upheavals, these ripping apart of community bonds, this woman, Molly, is no longer, and I don't blame her, is no longer going to feel as trusting when someone comes up to her and says, I love your dog, can we have this conversation? I don't blame her if she then feels less trusting. All of these social upheavals are benefiting Mark Zuckerberg and the other oligarchs. That's what really sticks with me, that these guys, and we heard from the court trials, as I talked about earlier, Mark Zuckerberg is never going to take one whit of responsibility for anything that he's done, even as thousands, millions of kids and women and other vulnerable people are being exploited by his technology, the algorithms, the pervert glasses, and everything else. Every day, he's never going to take any responsibility. Instead, he's going to take the money. He's going to take the money that he is enjoying from monetizing this destruction, bit by bit, of our social bonds. And as you heard in Mark Andreessen's little monologue about his lack of introspection, these guys don't even think about it. They have no introspection. They don't read. They have no knowledge of anything or anyone except themselves. What a lonely place that must be. So I do feel sort of bad for these guys, but they need to be in prison. for any crimes that they may have committed. You know, they need to face consequences for what they've done. And if that includes some criminal activity, they need to be in prison. And perhaps they will develop some introspection there. But in the meantime, we are all faced with these predatory platforms that are coming at us all the time. And look, to resist, the first step is awareness. That's why I'm spending an episode trying to go over these things. I'm trying to couch them in good news so that it's not so incredibly depressing as it sometimes is, or week after week in the show. I'm trying to give you some good news or some gloss of some good news aspect to the story. But the fact is, we have to face up to the very, very bad things that these oligarchs are doing every day. The awareness is the first step, and it's going to help us start to build, to rebuild, and to knit together our communities again. It starts with awareness. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors about the pervert glasses. Put up the posters. We do not allow pervert glasses in this institution, this bowling alley, this church, whatever it is. And that completes the fourth and final story of good news story of the dystopia update, good news edition. I'll just say that on the episode page at tectonic.fm, you can see a little meme. One of the memes is Mark Zuckerberg presenting his pervert glasses, and some interested graphic designer online, some memester, then put on the tagline "Pervert Glasses for Perverts" to be a meme worthy graphic that's worth sharing and explaining to your friends if they don't understand what that means. Make sure they know. Now I'd like to shift to the final phase of this show when we get to the surprise. And this is, there is a segue from what I've been talking about to this next segment. And it is that if we look at what the oligarchs have done to our society, they have ripped apart the social bonds. They have monetized the exploitation of children and women and other vulnerable communities. And I could give you the whole litany. But what I often don't get to is some of the details of day-to-day life that they have destroyed. And I came across, thanks to my friend Todd for sending me this, I came across an essay recently. It was written by a guy named Matthew Elefant that talked about a detail of New York City life that has been destroyed thanks to Silicon Valley. And the piece is called "San Francisco Killed New York Food Delivery." And it ran on March 13, 2026 in a site that's called ilovetheupperwestside.com. It's an Upper West Side of Manhattan blog, and that's the neighborhood where I live, and so I do like that site. And I thought the essay was just so perfect, talking about an aspect of New York City life that is no longer in existence thanks to the tech oligarchs. And I wanted to share this. I put together an audio segment that I had some fun with. I read the essay, and I put it together just because I love you, listeners. I wanted you to have a little bit of fun, a little bit of treat after this dystopia update, although this really is part of the dystopia update. I'm going to play you this now as I read Matthew Elefant's essay. I hope you enjoy it. "San Francisco Killed New York Food Delivery" by Matthew Elefant, March 13, 2026, published in ilovetheupperwestside.com. New York used to feed you. Not in the way cities talk about food now, the curated, the artisanal, the $9 delivery fee to bring you something from four blocks away. I mean, it fed you the way a city feeds people who actually live there, cheaply, reliably, without making you feel like a tourist in your own neighborhood. This was a system built by neighborhoods, run on memory and mutual obligation, and it worked so well that nobody thought to write it down, which is how the people who destroyed it were able to convince everyone it had never really existed. It existed. I was there. There was a Chinese restaurant on the Upper West Side, Amsterdam Avenue, somewhere in the 70s,
and I couldn't tell you its name, which tells you everything about how certain I was that it would always be there. You called them on the phone, an actual phone bolted to the kitchen wall with a cord that barely reached the counter. You dialed from memory because you had the number memorized, the way people used to memorize things that mattered. She picked up on the first ring, already yelling, L5, sauce on the side? You said, yeah. She hung up. And before your hand had left the receiver, I mean this literally, the doorbell rang. I know how that sounds, but I was there. There is a word for this kind of thing. The word is civilization. The man at the door was not a stranger. He worked at the restaurant. He knew you. He knew which buzzer in your building didn't work and came around the side. He knew the woman in 5C got her order every Tuesday and could use a container of milk, so he brought one. He knew I smoked, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes, there was a pack tucked into the bag. This wasn't charity. It was a deal. A direct, human, nobody-taking-a-cut arrangement between two people who had figured each other out over months of Tuesday nights. The restaurant sent him. Not a platform, not an algorithm. The people who cooked your food and knew your order sent someone they trusted into your building because that's how you took care of the people who took care of you. Now let me tell you about the drawer. Every New Yorker had one. Not a drawer, the drawer. You knew exactly which one. In most cities, that drawer holds silverware. In New York, it held menus. That was its entire purpose. Sacred, dedicated, understood by everyone without anyone ever having to say so. And people were proud of theirs. You'd go to a friend's apartment, same neighborhood, three blocks away, and before you'd taken your coat off, someone said, "Check out my drawer." And you looked, because it meant something. How deep was it? How many cuisines? Did they have the good Thai place on 82nd? The dim sum spot nobody knew about yet? Then the trading would start. Menus like baseball cards. "I'll give you the Szechuan place on 75th if you give me that Thai menu." "Deal, but I want the back number two, the one you call when the main line is busy." "The back number is not part of this negotiation." Nobody wrote any of this down. It lived in drawers and heads, passed between neighbors like something valuable, because it was. It was a library. It was a map. It was proof that you lived here, really lived here. Every grease stain, a timestamp, every folded corner, a Tuesday night you'd rather not fully account for. I knew people with binders, actual binders, labeled by cuisine, menus sleeved in plastic. At the time, I thought they were insane. Now I think they were the only sane ones. They were archivists, preserving something that was about to disappear without knowing it. The menus themselves were works of art. Not good art, but better than good art. Printed on paper that felt slightly damp and colors that had no business appearing together. 14 fonts, minimum. Clip art of a steaming bowl. The restaurant's name rendered in a typeface that suggested either Chinese antiquity or a 1987 laser printer, and sometimes both simultaneously. Completely illegible. Absolutely perfect. And yet, at the exact same moment that we loved these menus, collected them, showed them off, half of us had a sign on our front door that said two words, "No menu." Both things were true simultaneously. That was also New York. The signs never worked, and here's why. The restaurants weren't littering. They were auditioning. Every menu shoved under your door was a bid for a slot in the drawer. That was the whole game. Get in the drawer, get in the rotation, get the Tuesday night call. There was no Yelp, no algorithm, no sponsored placement. There was only the drawer. And if your menu wasn't in it, you didn't exist. So you sent a man out with 200 menus and a complete indifference to the no menu signs because the stakes were too high to be polite. I was annoyed by this at the time. I want to be honest about that. I used to crouch down and gather them up and think, does nobody read anything in this city anymore? I would give anything to come home to a pile of menus on my floor tonight. I would read every single one. You know what killed it? Stanford graduates in a conference room over a working lunch nobody ate. They looked at the whole system, the woman who knew your order, the man who knew your building, the drawer, the menus, the whole living, breathing, slightly greasy ecosystem of it, and they saw a problem. They saw inefficiency. They saw an opportunity to insert themselves between the restaurant and the customer and extract value from the gap. They were not wrong about the opportunity, but they were completely wrong about what the system was for. The system was not for efficiency. It was for the woman who remembered your sauce on the side, for the man who knew which buzzer worked, for the old woman in 5C and her Tuesday milk, for the restaurants that were auditioning desperately to get into your drawer because the drawer was the only algorithm that mattered. What replaced all of that was a platform. And a platform has no memory. A platform doesn't know you. A platform doesn't care whether your food is hot. A platform wants another order. Now I sit watching a dot crawl across a map. I watch it idle at a red light for 5 minutes, then another five. The app would like me to know that everything is fine. The food arrives cold on the hallway floor. Delivery fee, service fee, convenience fee, the cruelest invention. And then, before I've even seen what I've ordered, how much would you like to tip? For what exactly? For the floor? For the cold? My drawer still exists. It holds silverware now, like every other schmuck in every other city who never knew any better. Anyway, I have to go. My Uber is 4 minutes away. Did I ever tell you how cabs used to be?
And that was San Francisco Killed New York Food Delivery by Matthew Elefant, which was originally published in I Love the Upper West Side on March 13, 2026. I had a lot of fun putting that segment together. I hope you enjoyed it, listeners. And as the segment said, the oligarchs had no idea what the system was for. You know, it wasn't just about menus. It was about the community feel of people taking care of each other. And that's what we're losing as Silicon Valley continues its growth into all aspects of our life. Our job is to resist. And the first step is awareness. And I hope this show has done a little bit to assist you in that direction. And I hope you will take a look at the episode notes, tectonic.fm, in order to get some more ideas for how we can resist. Because together, friends, it's up to us to rebuild our communities, to re-knit the social fabric that Zuckerberg and Andreessen and Musk and all the rest have ripped apart as they have built their toxic sludge empires. But the good news from today's show is that there are little green shoots coming up everywhere, whether it's court victories or appropriate nicknames for surveillance glasses. We're seeing that people are beginning to push back. They're beginning to use their awareness to push back, and there's more interest in rebuilding our communities. And that's all the time I have for today. You're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And to go out, I have one more surprise for you, an opening monologue by Sam Rockwell in a very appropriate movie that I enjoyed watching recently. It's called Good Luck, Have Fun, Don't Die. I'd recommend it. It's fun. And I thought Sam Rockwell did a great job with this monologue. Have a good one, everybody. See you next time.
Hey. Hey! This isn't a robbery. I am from the future. And all of this goes horribly wrong. Horribly wrong. Are you engaged? Am I not engaging enough?
Traveling here today to tell you that things do not go well for you in the future. In fact, I'd say you are embarking upon the darkest possible timeline. It was all a giant mistake.
Would someone call the cops?
Social media has robbed you of your dignity and turned you all into children. Your fascist selfie culture has eroded your capacity for critical thinking. Stop it! No one leaves! Listen to my words. This is important. Like I said, I'm from the future. A future which is totally and completely... Guess what? It's all your fault. Not specifically you 40 or so people, but everyone from your time. You're all equally complicit, and I'm here to set it right. It all started with morning phone time. At first, people would wake up, check their emails in bed, look at Facebook, scroll Twitter, X, Y, Z, whatever, just a few minutes. No big deal. But morning phone time just got longer and longer. Eventually, people stopped getting out of bed entirely. Society fell apart. People had to be hooked up to feeding tubes and catheters. The medical supply industry boomed, but everything else, no one even noticed that the world had ended. Are any of you even listening to me?
Let me ask you something. Where did all the bookstores go?
Hey, good evening. That's the way we begin this show every week. The show is called It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I bring you this show, take full responsibility, blame, credit for it every Monday evening at 7, and glad you're there and listening. Lots of extraordinary music for to play for you tonight. We're going to start with this group, Athénor, I believe is the pronunciation. They are French, and we're going to hear a track from an album that's 10, 12 years old. I think it came out in 2013. So what's that, 13 years old? Help me out here. And this is a group that was very much influenced by Zool. I just talked about that last week, so I shouldn't go into it again. Zool basically is the sub-genre invented by the group Magma. Anyway, this is a really great piece of what you might call chamber prog, and this is the group Athénor.
Thank you.
there. Watch out. Music there from the group Athanor. They are French.